from that point, Janusz took my dad, without even thinking, took my dad into his house, told his mother, never told his father. And he was harbored, my dad figures, maybe 4 to 6 weeks in a basement cabinet. He was allowed out when it was safe, when Janusz felt like it was safe. And his sister, my dad's sister, had false papers throughout the war. So he would like connect with her from time to time. It turns out there was a point in the day, in the 4 to 6 week period, where my dad got suspicious and he ended up taking off, went south to towards Lublin. And he never was able to thank or say goodbye to Janusz. Years later, he ends up looking up what might have happened to Janusz, and he finds out that Janusz and his father had been hanged just weeks after harboring my dad.
Howdy, howdy. Everybody in the Beatitudes Nation, my name is Jeff Shufflebine. I'm so happy to be here along with Nicholas Besner.
That's me.
And Paul Kolker.
Top of the morning to you.
The three of us make up a global system called the Beatitudes. It's all about men walking together in authentic fraternity, chasing that deep relationship with our Lord, but doing it with humor and holiness. Right here at the Lucid Private Offices in Las Colinas, Texas.
Hey.
New sponsor.
Yeah.
I know their website. It's lucidprivateoffices.com. No, we love this place. In fact, I would highly encourage, if you ever get the chance, check out Lucid Private Office, but really come to this one, because there's something very special happening here. You walk through the halls, and it's just like friendship.
High fives. And
yeah, you smell incense.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
There, you might get sprinkled with holy water, so be prepared to genuflect at any moment.
Icons in random corners, yeah.
But they don't just have a Las Colinas. That just happens to be where we're sitting, right?
Well, this is the best one, yeah, but there's others that are great. This is just the greatest.
It's the first among equals.
There we go.
Yeah.
What is it? What else is the first among equals?
The Pope.
Yep. Yep. I knew it was somebody important. The other day, I thought about the word indelible, the indelible mark. Can you use indelible in another time besides the mark of a baptism?
Mark.
Yeah. Well, in the strict sense or like in a metaphorical
way? I'll take either at this point. I try to use indelible all day and I was indelibly stuck.
Indelible ink.
What is that?
It's like permanent marker.
Yeah, or you could say he left an indelible impression on me, right? Like I'll never forget that guy.
Yeah.
And when I returned my computer, I told him it was indelible. No?
Nope.
It's my favorite singer, too, is just your computer, Adele.
Okay, so we have
so
an...
So bad.
If you made it through 2 minutes, I promise the rest of the show is worth it.
It only goes up from here.
That's right. We set the low bar for our guests to crush it.
We brought in... I'm going to say one of the greatest guests we've ever had on the show, if you want some pressure, Andrew Rawicki.
Yeah. You know, I guess when I answered an email, you did say that I'm the best guest you've ever had because, or maybe you meant I'm the most thrifty guest, because to get free parking, you said I just got to read what you put in the guidance
and
send America a little email. Yep. And I did it. I guess I'm the only one that's ever done it. So.
He responded, and we were like, what is this?
Amazing.
He filled out the guest primer.
You said I was the best guest you ever
had. You submitted this?
He did his homework.
Most people just show up and get a parking bill.
Yeah. You actually just became one of the Beatitudes. One of us is being voted off the island.
Yeah. I have the most parking tolls, so I think I'm out.
This is all about free parking.
Jeff, we've enjoyed having you. Can you continue to edit the show?
Yeah, I'll sit over here and touch the buttons. Awesome. Andrew, thanks for being here. And also, this is the first show that America is live clicking buttons for us. I'm not even sure what those buttons do, but it's supposed to make editing easier.
She looks like she knows.
She looks excited.
She nodded as if with authority, yes. So that's
don't forget, press 1, then 2, then 3, then 1.
Oh, man. Yeah, oh, man.
She's keeping it all together.
You can see it happening on our monitor.
Okay, so Andrew... known you for a little bit, but turns out not all the Beatitude listeners know you yet. Okay. So we're going to change that today. I would like to share that all of us have these different connections to you, including that Paul and I got a chance to do a radio show with you one time that was pretty fun and pretty powerful. A
couple years back.
But the Raw Wikis, man, you guys are kind of all over our lives. Like, you're all over with, we've had your son-in-law,
yes,
Matt Reynolds from Celestial Beer Works.
He was in the first five guests.
Yeah.
Nice. Early on.
We started off with beer.
Yeah.
He was awesome. We have connections to you through the Highland School, where some of your grandkids go, and your son Bennett and his wife Trish, who I met outside of Mass one time. Several of us know your other daughter Madeline through Texas A&M.
Friends from Texas A&M. Whoop. Yep.
I met her. Whoop. I met her. Whoop. Thank you. Everybody has to.
I didn't think I had to since I was the intro of the.
Whoop for yourself.
Came back around.
I met her in Denver, though, of all places.
Yes.
And then we got Joe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to stop there. Listen, we got a lot of connections to you, but you, my friend, are an important part of our lives, and we are just going to turn this over to you and just say, first of all, why'd you say yes to coming on the Beatitudes?
I love the Beatitudes.
Yeah. Oh, man. I know why you asked that question.
If I'm starting to do anything that doesn't leave an indelible mark, America, please hit the right buttons, okay? Please. No, it's fantastic. I've listened and watched just about all of them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Any standouts? And I'm not really trying to
fish
here. I'd like to hear your feedback.
Very recently, I have made a trip up to Cincinnati, and I was part of a little get-together where we were introducing, part of that was to introduce some discernment before people chose, before people determined whether the Holy Spirit was asking them something.
Mm-hmm.
And before I sent 16 people into a holy half hour, I wanted to recall a little story about discernment that I'd heard recently, and it was your brother.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, that, as a high schooler, the fact that he was going in, you know, praying a novena, beautiful, wanting to see whether a bouquet of red roses or a bouquet of white roses would come, whether somehow red was Aggies. I don't know. I mean, that's maroon to me, but
close.
I was up in Ohio, so I, you know, anyways.
Yeah.
And then, or white to go into seminary. And then the fact that, okay, he day nine, he sees the red roses, he sees the white roses. Oh, and, you know, it always gets the same impression whenever you tell that story. Oh, well, Lord, what are you doing to me? But then, I mean, it was so beautiful to hear him say, okay, I have the freedom. I have the freedom.
Mm.
Just focus on me, the monstrance, Jesus in the middle here. And it was beautiful. Mm. And it worked. You know,
nice.
Everything, the Holy Spirit worked, and that.
Resonated with everybody?
It did.
Yeah.
It definitely did. And that's not the only time I've quoted the Beatitudes.
So, oh,
yeah, it's pretty cool. It's a pretty cool little gig you got here.
Well, thank you.
We may actually go get some more crogs just for you.
Oh, yes.
I thought we had left that in the past, but they're making a comeback.
All things are new with the Beatitudes. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to stop that.
Okay.
Andrew, you tell us a little bit about your career. I mean, I'm going to call it, you're in the second half of of life.
Yeah, sure.
They got onto me because before the show, I wrote down that you were in the fourth quarter.
I was overtime.
Possibly.
It's not up there now, so I'm calling it the second half. I never said that.
Not up there anymore. Yeah. Very good.
Well, let me see. I retired, and I moved to Joanna and I moved to Irving in 2019. Retired after almost 36 years in the energy industry, and you know, my story actually starts a little bit further back in the womb of my mother.
Yeah.
1960, game seven, Bill Mazeroski, ninth inning of a game seven, the only walk-off home run in a game seven in World Series history.
Wow.
So I was in the womb, and I became a Pittsburgh Pirate fan at that moment. You know? So, of course, we lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I was born in November of that year. And, you know, I have this strong loyalty to all things Pittsburgh. My wife of nearly 38 years knows that I will always be faithful to her because I have never dropped that loyalty to the Pittsburgh Pirates.
Yes,
no matter how miserable they are, and quite often they are very miserable. But you know, I was grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Went to Penn State. It's the only university I applied to. It's the only kind of thing I've always was thinking, okay, I'm going to grow up in this little Jewish family, go to Penn State, become a doctor. That was kind of the way things were laid out to me. It seemed great. I enjoyed the heck out of my young life, played a lot of tennis and baseball, and went off to the middle of Pennsylvania to school, studied pre-med, and then after about 2 years, I realized I didn't really want to be a doctor, mm-hmm. and I had never really thought about anything else I might want to do. I had always worked in restaurants and butcher shops and things like that, you know, in high school and the first couple of years of college. So I called my parents and said, I think I'm just going to drop out for a little while. And, you know, I was working at Pedro's Fine Mexican Food in State College, PA. And they said, I don't know. They called my sister, who was going to Kent State at the time. She had a bunch of friends at Penn State. And she said, you know, why don't you all get a hold of Andrew or Andy. I was called Andy back then. And, you know, talk some sense into him. And so I kept my kind of eyes and ears open. After that second year, I stayed up at school. I took sailing and anthropology, really working hard, and worked at the dining hall, worked at the Pedro's, and I was boarding at a fraternity house where my freshman roommate from the dorm had joined. And at the end of that summer, two guys came back from the oil industry after they had summer jobs, and they were super pumped up about what they had seen and done. And, you know, one of them was working offshore and one of them in Farmington, New Mexico. And they said, yeah, Andrew, you know, over a few beers, you should try this, you know, petroleum engineering. So I went and checked out petroleum engineering. They said, well, looks like a lot of your credits will go over. You'll probably have to stick around an extra year. And I'm thinking, well, this is, I loved Penn State. I was having a ball. I was, it's 600.
Okay, fine.
It was $600 for a trimester back then in state tuition. So I stuck around for a fifth year, the third, fourth, and fifth year in petroleum engineering. It was awesome because year five was the first year Penn State ever won a national championship. So that was
worth
a real treat.
It.
That was just a fantastic little episode there. And then I graduated. You know, I think that, you know, listening to those two gentlemen just changed my world completely, taught me a little something to just be open to things that, you know, I never would have thought about before, knew nothing about the oil industry. And then, but it doesn't always work out perfectly because when I got out in 1983, that was the first dip in the oil industry. Mm. So while the prior year, every single petroleum engineering grad had multiple offers, by 1983, 7 out of 106 of us had offers, I wasn't one of them. So I found one of those 7 that was close enough friend of mine that I could sleep on his couch down in New Orleans. So I waited for him to get settled in. I went on down there, couldn't get a job, of course, worked in some more restaurants, Chi-Chi's Fine Mexican Food, waiting tables at that point.
Because you knew the Mexican food market.
I knew that, yeah.
I can sling some fajitas.
Yeah, absolutely. And then an employment agent had gotten a friend of mine a job in the industry. I checked out that employment agent. All I had to do was sign a contract to pay them 25% of my gross salary for the first year. I did it, and the rest is history. It was a beautiful 36 year career with Gulf Oil and then Chevron. Took us all over the world. When I started that oil industry career in January of 1984, 23 plus years old, I was a little different than I am now. I don't think I had ever prayed. I had a bar mitzvah when I was 13, as a young Jewish boy would. I knew one person in 5 years at Penn State that had ever gone to a church. Mm-hmm. It was completely not a part of my life. I was going through the motions of living and enjoying myself. And, you know, now I had a pretty neat job. I'm still listening to people, you know, hey, you got a new job. Why don't you buy this diamond as an investment? So, yeah, okay, $924. You're going to send me a certificate with it. Okay, I got this little certificate. And then, you know, when I finally meet my wife a little while later, she's looking at this wee little thing. You can't even see it. It's like, I don't know if that's really going to be worth anything.
It's an investment.
It's an investment. So I tried to trade it in. Eventually, the people I tried to trade it into said, well, why don't you, I'll give you a ruby for $1,500. But no, instead, I got $75 for it when I traded it in.
But, the NFT of the day. NFT. Oh, no, that's going a different direction.
You know, I do try to listen, but I didn't always discern that well.
Sure.
So, yeah. So, anyways,
that's a great story.
I'm in the oil industry, and with Gulf Oil, I was in New Orleans, actually living in Burris for a while, kind of the end of the road. And I had a 1 month training school in Houston. And the first weekend of that training school, I go to this party with most of my friends had gone back to New Orleans to be with their wives or girlfriends. So I go out with two guys that I'd never been out with before or since. Likewise, this young lady, Joanna Bedingfield, shows up at this party at a Cafe Adobe restaurant in Richmond. It's not around anymore. It's in Houston. And we hit it off, and we were chatting about everything. And, you know, somebody was taking a little, okay, we'll go to this other guy's house and play charades at night. And basically, that was a Friday night. She was going to a Bruce Springsteen concert the next day because I wanted to go out with her again. So I said, okay, you're going to pick Bruce Springsteen over me. I asked her out for three dates that night. I said, how about Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday of next
week? I bought
a
diamond already.
It's an investment in us.
She thought that was okay. The Wednesday date went very well. The Thursday date, I was working pretty hard at this month-long school, and I fell asleep on the Thursday date.
Classic.
But she still stuck around for the Saturday date. We drove down to Galveston. I struggled with a cooler, muscled a cooler down to the beach at Galveston. And things were going okay. We were engaged after 7 weeks. When I went to Houston, I was certainly not interested in finding a wife. This just amazing woman right in front of me. Turned out she was a cradle Catholic as well. Getting to know her, because I wanted to get to know her, I just started to be, okay, what are you doing? You're going to church? Mass? Okay, it's called Mass. Okay, I'll go with you. You got these books on your shelf? I'll pluck one out. Mere Christianity was probably the first one I pulled out.
Good one.
Yeah, it was quite good. Quite good. And, one thing kind of led to another. So we're engaged. She's teaching hearing impaired children, little kindergarten first graders in Houston. I wait for her to finish that first year of, or her second year of teaching, the first year I knew her. And we got married in June of 1986. And I moved her over to New Orleans. And from there, it was first baby was born 9 months and 2 days after we were married.
Of course.
Next one, 11 months later. Then Luke came, the following year, 1987, 88, 89, 90, 91. That took us from New Orleans to Houston, the first move that we made as a family. After we had five little babies, the call came to go to Australia. As a matter of fact, I was going to be working offshore, northwestern Australia, and my boss said, hey, this is pretty, I think you'll compete well for this job. It was in deepish water at the time. That's what I was doing.
Is deepish a term?
Deepish. It was at the time. Oh. So 1992, we're talking about a couple thousand feet of water.
Okay. I was going to say,
as opposed to 10,000.
Today, yeah.
Like that. I love deepish pizza.
Deepish pizza, I turned, I called my wife and she said, I can't move to Australia, foreign country with five little kids and have you leaving 2 weeks at a time. So I went back to my boss and said, no, he looked at me. Nobody ever turns down an opportunity to move to Australia. But okay. My wife calls me back later that day. Her mother had just been widowed. And she would consider going with us to Australia. So we packed up our five little kids. We went from Houston to Los Angeles. Kids were crazy at midnight waiting for this, there were only three adults and five little kids, and their eyes were rolled back in their heads. It was absolutely crazy in the airport. And then we board this flight, And of course, because it's a longer than 6 hour flight, we get to fly business class. So all these business travelers are looking at our kids across the, you know, the five kids right across that whole, thankfully they slept all the way to Sydney and then another 5 hours to get to Perth. That was an incredible adventure. So all the little five kids came back with Aussie accents, went from there to California, back to New Orleans, to Bakersfield, to San Jose, had our sixth child in that mix, went to back to Houston for a second time, Poland, Houston for a third time, Midland, and that's kind of the way my career unfolded. It was dynamite. I loved every job I had. I loved every place I lived. My kids all had college essay material by how much they had to adapt, you know, all the moves that I subjected them to. Some of them weren't always that thrilled with me. They do all appreciate, I think, now what they went through. So that was that allowed me to get to a position where, I've come to a place where I can retire and be very close to four of our six children and eight of our 10 grandchildren.
Wow.
So it was, you know, I'll back up to the part where we lived in Houston, where we had our fourth child born. As I was mentioning, I was going through kind of doing things, going to mass, reading some books. I had never considered converting to Catholicism. My wife had never brought it up. I found out later, of course, that she was praying. Her mother and father were praying. We went to a talk by a Father Kenneth Roberts up in Conroe, Texas. I don't even know what the subject of the talk was, but at the end of the talk, he did an altar call, which doesn't sound a whole very Catholic, very unusual. But anyways, I was crying, and I went down there, and I said, yeah, I want to give my life to Jesus. And I didn't even know, you know, I don't know what came over me. You know, the Holy Spirit came over me.
Yeah.
So my wife didn't even understand as a cradle catch. She didn't understand RCIA. I thought we maybe got to get baptized with our little baby, the Fort Nathaniel, who hadn't been baptized yet. But no, okay, RCIA. And I entered the church in 1991. And it's been a wild ride since. So half of my life, I've been catching up on some pretty darn good stuff.
Well, you had an Old Testament phase and a New Testament phase.
I did, yes.
That's awesome.
Yes.
So. Your roots, we've kind of glossed over a little bit, but there's a lot more to the story of your roots than just having a Jewish upbringing.
Yes.
Can you take us back to your father?
Of course.
The team at Aquinas Wealth Advisors believes that good values and good returns are not mutually exclusive. Using a tech-smart and morally sound approach, they provide investment alternatives that align with Catholic teachings without sacrificing returns. These days, faith-driven investors are finding it hard to know where their money is going. They have no visibility into what their dollars are supporting, but there's a better way. Thanks to the Faith and Finance Score from Aquinas Wealth Advisors, you can look into your current holdings to see what you're supporting and make a switch to an advisor that aligns with your values and gives power to your voice. Check out AquinasWealth.com today.
Hey, Beatitudes, it's Jeff here. When Nick and I set out and we started this company, Undivided Life, we decided to not use traditional healthcare, but we went with Solidarity Healthshare because we thought it was an affordable and ethical alternative that matched the needs of our business and our growing families. Since then, my family put Solidarity to the test. We've had pregnancies, babies, emergency room visits, even a brain surgery for one of my children, and Solidarity has been an incredible partner and has also had the cost and the ethical approach that we love. Here's a link for you to go check it out. learnmore.solidarityhealthshare.org/beatitudes. This is your chance to be in solidarity with the Shufflebine family.
Hi, it's Paul Kolker from the Beatitudes here, and I just wanted to share with you guys that I also, outside of the show, perform improv comedy on a regular basis with a group called Divine Comedy. So what we do is we come up with everything on the spot. So whether you're looking for faith-filled, fun, family-friendly comedy for your youth night, or whether you're looking for clean comedy for your corporate event, Divine Comedy can perform for your group and even get you in on the action. So if you'd like to hire us to come out and perform for your next event, check out DivineComedyImprov.com. Divine Comedy, an inferno of fun.
So my father is, and he came over from Poland. He was a Holocaust survivor. So when he was a day away from starting high school as a 12 and a half year old, the Nazis came into his hometown of Płock, Poland, resettled his family to Bodzentyn, to a little storefront, two-street ghetto. And from there, very squalor conditions. His sister had typhus. His mother just, you know, just was pained by so much and just so giving. It was beautiful, example for my dad. My dad's father went off to find some work in Warsaw, so he was in the Warsaw ghetto. My dad and one sister were plotting to go join up with my dad in Warsaw. At the time, my mother and the sixth sister were sent to Treblinka and to the gas chambers. My dad and his one surviving sister made it to Warsaw. They were in the Warsaw ghetto. My dad was a courier going in and out of the ghetto, trying to pick up supplies, barter this and that. He had
as a 12-year-old.
Yeah, 12, 13, 14, 15, basically these. Yeah, his probably the Warsaw ghetto years was 14, 15. Yeah. So, his story is absolutely harrowing. I mean, there are so many, so many close calls, so many miraculous stories of him living that makes me, particularly as a faithful person, you know, wonder, okay, why? And it's, you know, just one story after the other. There's it's captured beautifully. I'll speak a little bit more in a second about where it's captured. But so he's escapes from the Warsaw ghetto when it's being obliterated by Nazi tanks. I mean, some of the ammunition, small munitions that he's brought in as a courier, you know, they're firing Molotov cocktails at these tanks. And of course, the ghetto is being obliterated. Somehow he is able to slip through a few bricks that were missing in the wall. Again, you know, somebody's shooting at him, and then their attention has to turn somewhere else because a rogue shot fires from somewhere else. He goes down to the riverbank, the Vistula River, and he meets up with three young men who are playing hooky from school. They are telling stories. And my dad's dad had always told him, you must keep a clean shirt. You absolutely must keep a clean shirt. For if you ever get out of here, you need to look somewhat presentable. So he put on his clean shirt when he got out, looked somewhat presentable, I guess, very emaciated. And then he was with these boys, you know, telling stories, acting cool. One by one, the boys left. And my dad eventually said, you know, the one last man, young man Janusz, said, well, it's time to go. And my dad somehow confided in him, I have nowhere to go. I'm a Jew. And he remembers Janusz saying, Holy Mother of God. And from that point, Janusz took my dad, without even thinking, took my dad into his house, told his mother, never told his father. And he was harbored, my dad figures, maybe 4 to 6 weeks in a basement cabinet. He was allowed out when it was safe, when Janusz felt like it was safe. And his sister, my dad's sister, had false papers throughout the war, so he would connect with her from time to time. It turns out there was a point in the day, in the 4 to 6 week period, where my dad got suspicious, and he ended up taking off, went south to towards Lublin, and he never was able to thank or say goodbye to Janusz. Years later, he ends up looking up what might have happened to Janusz, and he finds out that Janusz and his father had been hanged just weeks after harboring my dad. My dad worked very hard at getting some recognition for Janusz. That's in Polish and Hebrew. But at Yad Vashem in Jerusalem, a righteous among Gentiles, righteous among nations, for anybody that's done heroic deeds in saving Jews during World War II. So that this is just a replica of the plaque that resides in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. You know, I love telling my stories about my dad and telling, you know, the horrors he saw. By the way, his dad was shot and killed. It was a little trick that he was told, okay, you need to leave the Tebbins factory in Warsaw, and we're going to go to somewhere that's more productive. And all the men that left were shot and killed. So my dad was orphaned at that point. He talks about all these horrors. My dad says he wasn't ever really sure there is a God. And, you know, it's pretty understandable that you would think maybe there's no God. But I also find out way late in life that my dad has prayed the Ojcze Nasz, which is the Our Father in Polish, every day of his life for Janusz since he left. And can I tell one more story?
You can tell every story you want.
Okay. So there's also a little story of after the war, he makes his way. I said he left Warsaw. He went down to Lublin. He worked on a pig farm for a little while. Again, could have been killed several times there. Was standing right next to a boy that was shot and killed, right next to him, right, you know, just crossfire between Russians and Germans at that point. But again, he survived somehow. He actually was, after Russia liberated that part of Poland, he was a guard. He was made a guard at Majdanek concentration camp where many, many Jews were put to death. Now they were, the German soldiers that were at Majdanek were now prisoners waiting for their trials. And he was there. He befriended. I mean, I wouldn't say befriended, but he was the guard for these people, and he kind of understood what they were following their order. My dad had a very amazing outlook on life. Anyways, he makes his way to Western Poland, Wrocław, which was formerly Breslau, and he's finally catching up on all his schooling that he had missed while he was during the war, and going to a Catholic school, he has false papers because he still doesn't trust anybody to even divulge that he's Jewish. And he's at a Catholic school. The priest, you know, knows that he's not really Catholic. And they run into each other at a marketplace. And he says, "Hey, Jerzy, you know, I haven't seen you at confession lately." And you know, my dad decides to tell him, "I'm not really Catholic." And he said that in Polish, of course. But I'm not really Catholic. And the priest hands him a holy card. And he writes victory on the back in Polish. Okay, this is 1948. So my dad, he was trying to get into, like, do a little pre-law. The communists at the time had told him, "We're not going to continue to educate you if you keep a passport, because then you're just going to leave." So he had to choose. He chose to keep his passport, thankfully. He made his way to Sweden, to Ellis Island. So stayed in New York for a little bit, went to South Bend, Indiana, Birmingham, Alabama. He was an optician at the time, making glasses. Went to Pittsburgh for about 25 years. That's when I was born. Went to St. Petersburg, Florida, about maybe 25, 30 years. And it comes time for one of our children to be making his first professions of poverty, chastity, and obedience in 2011 at Cheshire, Connecticut. And my mom and dad come up for it. It's beautiful. My son Luke, brother Luke at the time, had arranged for my dad to give one of these talks, because he'd been giving talks for 20, 30 years by that point. He never talked about it when I was growing up, but his wartime experiences. So he's given a talk to the novices in Cheshire, Connecticut. And he tells this story that I just told you about this living in Wrocław and, you know, acting like he was Catholic, but getting this holy card. And he pulls out this holy card. In 2011, I've never heard the story. Why has this Jewish man kept this holy card where did he keep it? You know,
yeah.
For all of those different moves in his life to give it, you know, it was actually during the Q&A, somebody had asked him a question and he tells this story and hands it to my son. And so my son obviously cherishes that holy card. It's his, you know, flash forward to 2022, my son was ordained a priest, and that was the image on his ordination card. And so That's my dear old dad. Didn't believe in a God, but for some reason, he kept that holy card.
Victory.
Our Lady had something to do with that. You know, prayed the Oichanash every day. So I got a lot from my dad.
You showed up here with this this honorarium diploma. I don't even know what to call this now, but you showed up with it and you said, let me just bring it in just in case, but can you talk about why this, your father didn't talk about this very much?
Yeah. I mean, I think like so many people that were scarred by the Holocaust, he worried about passing those scars on. And so nothing, when my sister and I were growing up, there was never a mention of World War II. I mean, we knew that he went through some stuff, but that's all my mother would divulge. Mm-hmm. And, hey, he was Jewish in World War II. Of course, when you start to go to school, you understand how Jews were treated in World War II. But no, we knew not to ask, and we didn't ask. And it was my wife. A lot of people claim to be the person that opened. I claim that it was my wife that got him to open up finally when he lived in St. Petersburg. It was time, and he joined the Florida Holocaust Museum board. He ended up, at his funeral, he passed away 2/22/22, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
So he was almost 95 at the time. When he passed away, the Florida Holocaust Museum, which is in St. Petersburg, offered to have the reception after his funeral at the synagogue. I heard so many more stories. I mean, all these people that he had touched, he used to go to the Holocaust Museum, sometimes three or four times a week, just telling his story, reading books, talking, he has plaques up there in the museum about him and others that he knew. So it's, obviously it's just a horrific time in our history, but there's just such beauty in being able to come out of that I'm going to mention in a second here, there's this 43-minute documentary of him walking the streets of present-day Warsaw. This was when he was 86 years old. It's providence that for some reason, I worked for Chevron. They've been around for almost 150 years. Three of those years, they decide to explore in Lithuania, Poland, Romania, Bulgaria, and Ukraine. For two of those years, I'm the operations manager over there. So I'm based in Warsaw. It happens to coincide with the 70th commemoration of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. So April of 1943, April 19th, that's when all that crap started happening. They're throwing, Molotov cocktails at tanks and getting obliterated. That's what he lived through. Nobody lived through that. Anybody that did live through that was sent right to a death camp.
Yeah.
So, the people that were still, so the 70th commemoration, the prime minister, the president, the mayor of Warsaw, everybody was there. It was this beautiful, they just opened a new museum in Warsaw, Museum of the History of Jews in Poland. And this was where all the activities were. Anybody else that was a survivor was like an infant at the time. And
there's no living memory of it. Yeah.
Except for my dad. So my dad would self-identify as, hey, I was in that. He would be asking a question of these people that were on the stage that were infants at the time. They were telling their stories, and he would self-identify as, okay, I was there. And then afterwards, you couldn't keep people away from him. I had to go, eventually the crowd got so big, I had to go find, of course, I didn't speak Polish, but I had to go eventually find a microphone where he could stand in the side of this auditorium that we had just been in. Eventually they had to, he was there speaking so long that we had to pull out and go into the lobby, and he spoke much longer. It was so therapeutic for him. He was, his horrific memories, not just of the war, but even like an anti-Semitic Poland before the war. He was in grade school. His buddies, he would play, do gymnastics with. All of his buddies were his friends until it was time to go to catechism, and then the Jews would go to their thing, and they would get epithets thrown at them. Oh, Christ killer, this and that. These were his friends, from before the war. So
yeah.
And so he was so heartened by the fact that people wanted to hear his story.
Yeah.
By the fact that the media put that first, uprising, the ghetto uprising, they called it the first uprising, as opposed to the August 1944 huge uprising, the whole city of Warsaw that basically got its place burned. you know, calling it the first uprising really put it on the same kind of a plane. And, you know, as I say, it was extremely therapeutic. It was beautiful. My dad stayed 3 months with us. He grabbed a film crew. He walks this present day streets of Warsaw recounting his memories. And he doesn't talk about Janusz in that story because he couldn't. So usually whenever I was with him, I would tell that part of the story.
He couldn't because
it was just too emotional.
Too much.
For him. Yeah, too emotional for him. The fact that he was not able to ever thank him, not able to. Yeah. Mm. But he tells some amazing stories. I think you've seen the video.
Yeah. It's amazing. What's the name of it for people listening?
Behind the Walls. You could Google. It's on YouTube. Behind the Walls. Google Jerry Rawicki. Behind the Walls. Jerry Rawicki. Or
we can put it in the show notes.
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so well worth. It's got a nice Chopin soundtrack to it, and it's got some humor. He's a funny guy. He could be a pretty goofy guy. He liked to watch Naked Gun and
Leslie Nielsen fan.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. So does his son. So
let me ask you this: having heard some of this story before, can you talk about your mom?
Yeah, sure. My mom, again, big baseball fan. Big, you know, she was very.
When you leapt in the womb?
Yes. I leapt in the womb. Actually, I should say, a big fan of any team that was winning. So, you know, she ended up in St. Pete, she became quickly a Tampa Bay Rays fan because they were winners at the time. She was loving to me. She was a little bit hard to understand for a lot of people. Her nickname around the neighborhood was Hank. She was pretty, come on pretty strong, drive pretty fast in the neighborhood every once in a while, open, you know, maybe a little bit mad, open the electric garage door and then crash into the back of the garage, you know, where my dad had built a nice partition and they'd have to rebuild it and stuff like that, you know. So she had, she worked in sports stores. She was very, you know, she was kind of gung-ho, full-on, jogger, tennis, whatever she was involved in, she would, like, go after it, worked in sports stores. But, you know, a little bit loving to me, but a little off-putting to some people, maybe a little tough to get along with.
Any pushback from your folks as you went through your conversion with Joanna?
Yeah. They loved Joanna from the get-go, which was made things very easy. Easy to love, she is.
7 weeks to engagement, yeah.
Still easy to love.
Well, when you already have a diamond.
Put that rock somewhere.
the news that I was getting married, you know, of course, it came quick, but they were thrilled with that. The news that I was converting to Catholicism, I think, probably also didn't surprise my mom and dad that much, but they did. My dad asked that I not tell two of his relatives because they would have considered it a slap in the face. And of course, I heeded that. And they may have seen a few holiday cards with, you know, Christmas decorations around, and, you know, a lot of kids dressed up for Christmas. Like, but
you can see, you know, it, just don't say it.
Yeah, I didn't say it.
That's right.
But
that's right.
And they're long since passed, of course. Yeah. And so
when did your mom pass?
My mom passed actually right before we moved to Poland, which, you know, that was another, you know, kind of providential in that I don't think my mom and dad would have made that trip to Poland. And my dad was quite ill after his wife of almost 56 years died, and we just thought he was, you know, in depression. It turns out he had, like, a congestive heart failure, but he put April 19th on his calendar for that following year. So we moved to Poland in 2012. He put April 19th, 2013 on his calendar, and he resolved to get healthy so that he could come see us. So he did. He flew over by himself at 86 years old. As I say, he spent 3 months in that area. His one surviving sister was still alive in Israel at the time. So he went down and spoke with her and stayed 2 weeks with her while we were basically at the Molly and Madeline's graduations from college. We're like 10 days apart.
Yeah.
And so we came over and did that kind of thing. So he got to see his sister. I guess that would have been the last time he got to see her in Israel. She was about 91 at the time, and she passed shortly after. So, you know, it was a lot of providence in there.
One of the only probably teenage boys to escape the Warsaw ghetto through what ends up being like a small hole in some bricks with a clean shirt, makes it all the way to America and has, you know, how many kids did he have?
Well, he just has the one surviving, had one surviving sister.
You're surviving. No, how many kids did he have?
Oh, he has two kids.
You and
So my sister has one daughter, and then I have the six, and then my sister's daughter has one, so there's 11 grandkids.
Yeah,
in
the abundance of life, the fruitfulness of life, the fact that, you know, not ever knowing you first or knowing any story about your father, the impact that your children and your grandchildren being connected to my children through the school, all those connections, you look at like the fruit and the legacy of one human life, and I
that shouldn't have lived. I mean, you really should not have lived. There's actually, you know, his sister that survived the war ended up in England, whereas my dad came to the U.S. She ended up having two kids. So I have two first cousins because my mother was an only child. So I have two first cousins. The male first cousin, Alan, has three kids himself. One of them is a rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi.
Awesome.
His daughter is married to an Orthodox rabbi. And then my dad had a Catholic priest for a grandson.
Yeah, Jerzy is putting out some religion, some, like I always joke, religious, you know, we got one of your sons is a lawyer, you married to a doctor, married, and then you got the beer master, the brewmaster for a son-in-law. I'm like, Jerzy, thanks for...
Yeah.
Well, Madeline, when it looked like her three older brothers were like picking a path for themselves way early, she said, a doctor and a lawyer and a priest walk into a bar. It's just the raw wikis. Little joke. And of course, yes, Bennett did become a lawyer, Nathaniel a doctor, Luke a priest. But we didn't know about the bar at the time. But yeah, Molly marries
the bar.
Molly marries Matt. Now, we also, unfortunately, when she was projecting her older brothers, the younger brother is an engineer now, too. It just wasn't part of the joke, so we got to work him in somehow.
It's got everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's got everything. Oh, my goodness. Awesome. I got to brag on your wonderful wife for a second. We had a first communion just weeks ago, first Holy Communion for one of your granddaughters and for my second daughter. And at the end of Mass, Father Edwin has people like, if you want a rosary or a relic or anything, just blessed, like hold it up. We'll do a blessing to kind of finish this off. And I look and your wife is, y'all are right in front of us. And she's holding up this amazing, just little medallion for Saint Benedict's medal kind of on this little stand. And I'm like, gosh, that's beautiful. And I'm holding on to my rosary and I'm holding on to my son Benedict. And we're having this very emotional moment. And when it's all done, I'm sitting there praying and open my eyes, and Joanna's sitting there, and she's handing me the St. Benedict medal that she just had blessed, and I was like, oh, will you marry me? I'm kidding, Amanda.
You're kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. You know your wife listens to this show, right?
She also loves Joanna my wife very much. Your family is so loving, and it's beautiful to see the way that they've all been raised. I also got to tell you, I think it was Chaley, your granddaughter Chaley. I smiled at her and waved when she was in the pew, and she winked at me. But it was like one of those winks that a 30-year-old can pull off. And I was like, whoa, how did you pull that? I was like, did you know she can do this? And Trish is like, yeah, we know. She's cunning.
Yes. That's a skill. Yes.
I'm going to open up. I would like for you to explain what I'm about to open up, but I'm going to pour us each a glass of something to enjoy, if you can explain this.
Sure. So this is probably going to be a Polish lager made by Celestial Beer Works, my son-in-law, and the business where his wife is the art director. So that's her art of my dad's smiling face.
Hold this up for camera two here.
It's a Polish lager. The hops were flown in from Lublin, actually the area where he ended up right after the war. Interestingly enough, Matt and Molly got a chance. This is just... you can't make this stuff up. Matt and Molly, they have been selling some of their beer in Europe. A distributor in the Netherlands has been grabbing pallets from time to time. And they had a beer fest in Poland, and it turns out it's in Wrocław. And that's, again, that's the town where my dad got that holy card.
Oh, my
and he worked. And so they're wandering around Wrocław. My dad, while he was going to school, he was also, interestingly enough, working in a brewery. And that brewery was changing names because it had been German when it was Breslau. And they had a contest to name the new brewery. And my dad actually won that contest. He pulled out the name Piast from an old Polish dynasty. And so that's part of history also, that my dad has, you know, long before his son-in-law ever started brewing beer, he was naming the brew Piast, which is, it still exists, but it's brewed by Carlsberg now. So this is a Polish lager. So when Matt and Molly went over to Poland just last month, they not only were in that beer fest, but they went down to Lublin where they purchased those hops. They planted some of their own hops. So when those things grow, they can get them back over here and they can say they've been part of the whole mix. So yeah, it's a fine Polish lager. Here's to the memory of Jerzy. God bless his soul.
God bless
him. Prost? What do you say?
Yeah. To victory?
There you go.
To victory.
Y'all listen while we drink.
It's nice.
Yeah. I actually drink this at home quite a bit. I think it's wonderful.
Yeah.
So there's a barcode on here, or the QR code, as the kids call it.
or just anybody who understands the technology.
Kids.
That QR code will take you to the Behind the Walls documentary that I mentioned.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's...
And it's on every can. That is awesome.
It's on every can.
Gets it out there.
There's a little mural on the back, of a mural devoted to my dad, Papaw, Holocaust survivor, on the back of Celestial. It's a beautiful tribute. And
the end of this says, you know, it goes to the story that you've just shared with us, and it's pretty powerful. And in the smallest amount of words, it hits you pretty hard. But then it says, you know, you can watch this here, watch to learn a little about this intelligent, kind, brave, magnetic man. I think that describes you. I think you are those things.
I'd be honored to have that as an epithet.
Well, yeah. I feel like it's, you know, you throw in your faith and the love that you have for your faith, and this is like you are the living legacy and carrying on of your son.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I'm your dad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we all are, yeah. Yeah, we're
That's right.
The Relwickies carry it on, and it's pretty awesome.
I'm going to give you some really weird trivia before we kind of get towards the end of this, because I printed up some things about legacy things that don't sound like they could be true, and I heard them on the internet. So,
they have to be.
I did actually look these up. I'm going to give you the weirdest one first. If you've heard this before, it's mind-blowing. The 10th president of the United States, this is not a quiz, but you actually know who it is.
Harrison or something?
No shot.
Close. I mean, close because he was a president.
Garfield?
Also very close.
Tyler.
John Tyler.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. John Tyler was the 10th president of the United States. He was born in 1790. He took office in 1841. His son, Lyon Gardner Tyler, was born in 1853 when Tyler was 63 years old. He had a son. In turn, that man had six children with two different wives, including Harrison Ruffin Tyler, who was born in 1928. So when that man was pretty old. When that man was in his 70s, John Tyler's grandson is alive today. He's 94 years old.
What?
Yeah.
Whoa.
Now, when I first learned about this 10 years ago, there was two of them.
The grandson of the 10th president.
And I looked up everything today to make sure I was still accurate. The grandson of the 10th president is still alive. You want to talk about legacy?
Crazy.
That's wild. Okay.
Here's my next one.
What the heck?
Here's my next one for you.
That seems impossible.
It does. Spanning two centuries.
Right.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. There's stuff like this that I don't claim to understand how it works.
It's just providence.
All right. Here's the next one. The sailors are not your average family. They're identical, or there's identical twin sisters, Brittany and Brianna, and they met identical twin brothers, Josh and Jeremy, at, of all things, a twin festival in 2017. I didn't know that was a thing.
No, well, they always have two of them a year.
Oh, yeah.
But they happen at the same time.
Yeah, well, yeah, across the street from each other.
Okay, identical. The couples tied the knot in a double wedding ceremony a year later, creating a truly unique family. But that's not all. Within months of each other, the sisters gave birth, each to a boy, who these... These boys are genetically brothers, but technically cousins.
What?
Due to their parents all being identical twins on both sides.
But they have different fingerprints.
my head just exploded.
This makes me think of when your brother was on the show and we were calling him brother, father, Kevin.
Brother, father.
This is your cousin brother. Yeah.
double cousins.
Yeah.
This is my cousin brother, Billy brother, cousin.
Hey, what happens if one of them becomes a priest? Cousin, brother, father.
This is my identical cousin, brother, father. My identical cousin. Anyways, I don't know. This stuff blew me away, and I had to share.
Legacy.
None of that is anywhere close to the story.
It is.
Jerzy.
That's very relatable.
No, but it's just wild the way God will, like you said, you mentioned number of times in your story about Providence, God's providence, and just the way that he'll step in and help direct things, because obviously we don't see the fullness of everything going on behind the scenes. I mean, he knows what he's doing. We often only get a glimpse of what's actually happening, and so that's not to say that he loves anybody that didn't make it out of Warsaw any less, but he had a plan for each person, and maybe it was that person's time, you know, that was still there and didn't get out. I mean, you know, we can't see all of that, but I just think it's amazing the way God's providence paints these incredible stories that really show us that he's still active in this world when it could have all been obliterated, right? Like, it could have all been just a dark night of the soul for everybody.
Yep, amen.
Your dad had, such a very clear understanding and knowledge of suffering as a 12, 13, 14. It wasn't like an infant that just all of a sudden has a change in their livelihood.
Right. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, 12-year-olds today are like, what are their...
28-year-olds today.
Yeah, right. Well, what are their big struggles?
Affording Fortnite.
Yeah. I think. A new skin.
Yeah, a new skin on Fortnite.
That's what I was going to say. A new emoji. On Fortnite.
You're about 15 years behind.
Gun emoji.
Well, when you watch the video, I mean, part of it's he was just a 13-year-old kid.
Right.
And a lot of times he acts like, oh, he was just doing stupid things. He was like a lark is what he calls it, you know.
Mm.
He really did some really dangerous and stupid things because he was a 13-year-old kid.
Sure.
But then he also did a lot of growing up, you know, having to decide whether to, you know, cover up the eyes of this person that's going to die because, well, he's seen enough people that are dying. He knows they're probably within 15 minutes, I'll stick around.
Well, and just his instinct, instinct too, to be able to flee the scene of, you know, to detect and pick up on that sense of danger and maybe some spiritual prompting there too.
Where
from
he's
God.
Being, yeah, like you think you're in a safe spot, but he knows he needs to get out.
Yeah, how do you know that at that age?
Right.
Right. Yeah. Like that's incredible.
Yeah.
Man, Andrew, why don't you tell some good stories next time we get together?
I'd love to. There's probably a few more in there.
Oh, my goodness.
Just incredible.
Well, I got to say that anybody who's listening to this is blessed by this. If people don't know these types of stories, I encourage you to go deeper. Go deeper into this one specifically. Go watch this video. It's in the show notes. You know, and I think about, all of us have our struggles. You still have struggles. And what a difference it is. You know, my family's going through something pretty big right now, but it's like struggles of life. You know, we're dealing with treatments, we're dealing with brain cancer, and it's very serious. I'm not trying to diminish that at all, but what a blessing that I woke up today with all my kids there and we're going back to treatment today. And I think about that versus what your father had to face, knowing of siblings and a father and all these terrible things that have already happened and his mother. I mean, that's...
Yeah. And just the will to survive and to keep going when so many people would naturally just give up in a circumstance like that. Yeah, yeah, that's incredible.
All right.
Sorry, I didn't mean to pounce on what you...
100%. Yeah. No, I'm 100% with you. I think that we're going to see you back on the Friday show. We're going to be talking about the fourth quarter of your life.
We're second half if we don't want to pin him down too harshly.
But what if it's one of those sports that takes forever?
Hey, Jeff, how's double OT going for you over there?
Well, and that's my point. Like, I didn't say what sport it was. Some of them, after the two-minute warning, it takes another 6 hours.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a good point.
Yeah.
You make a compelling case to justify your wording.
Yes.
Andrew, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about what his life looked like after the corporate working world and all the impact you're still continuing to have.
Love to.
Yeah. So for anybody listening to, I actually got to say this. I went to Yad Vashem where this honor is.
Yes.
It was one of the most gut-wrenching places I've ever gone in my life. And at the same time, you feel like this sense of purpose coming out of there that you have to own who you are in the world to other people and not just be a passive observer in life.
Yeah.
Yeah, powerful. Okay, folks, we are going to see you in the next time we get a chance to toast to our friend Jerzy Rawicki. And for the rest of you, we will
see you in the Eucharist.
God bless you all, and God bless Jerzy Rawicki.
Amen. Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to join us at our undersized table, subscribe to the video version of the show on YouTube by typing at, that's the symbol at, so shift and two on your keyboard, @ the_Beatitudes on YouTube. We'll see you there.